On Debt, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Debt, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to Immigrantly. This is Sadia Khan. Last week's episode with Shahjahan Khan and Rafi Rashid sparked an incredible response. Thanks to everyone who listened, shared, and gave feedback. It was indeed a raw and candid conversation about their personal struggles and the journey towards healing and self-discovery. If you haven't had the chance to listen, I highly recommend checking it out. And don't forget to share it with someone who might find it helpful. Today, I have the honor of hosting Dr. Anne Anlin Cheng, a distinguished scholar and author whose work profoundly explores the intersections of race, aesthetics, and cultural history. As a professor at Princeton University, she has authored groundbreaking books like The Melancholy of Race, Psychoanalysis, Assimilation and Hidden Grief, and Second Skin, Josephine Baker and the Modern Surface. Her work challenges the way we, you and I, think about race, gender and identity, offering new perspectives on ideas of beauty, art and the human experience, which, to be honest, is so important in the age of social media. She invites us to re-examine our perceptions of the world and each other in truly transformative ways. I cannot wait to partake in this important conversation with her. So without further ado, let's get started. Welcome to Immigrantly, Anne. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you are based in...
Princeton University.
Yes. And I've been meaning to go to Princeton because I know somebody who lives there and I haven't done that. I've lived in New York for 14 years and have not been to Princeton.
Well, that's not surprising. I think there's a way in which New York itself is such a whole universe that one tends not to go out. I completely invite you to come visit because it's actually a very beautiful town. It's very green, lots of trees, flowers. It's a very bucolic, you know, slightly unreal, but quaint town. And actually, we have lots of visitors. I mean, the town is filled with tourists. And so, yeah, come visit. It's very peaceful and very pretty. It's a nice break from New York City.
I don't live in the city. So I live in the burbs. And where I live, we have a lot of trees and it's very calm. As you said, it's a small town among many other towns nearby. So I can visualize how Princeton might be. And especially in fall, oh my gosh, these towns look amazing in fall.
Well, I lived in California for many, many years. And so coming back to the East Coast, I really love the four seasons.
Yeah.
You know, I love having the fall and I love having spring instead of just, you know.
Just one season.
Yes, because I lived in San Francisco, which is actually quite cold. And you can't swim in the ocean, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, people think, you know, tourists come in their shorts, but it's actually too cold for that.
And so let's go back to your childhood. How old were you when you moved to the U.S.?
I was 11 years old.
And you moved from Taiwan?
Moved from Taiwan. We lived in the city of Taipei.
Paint me a picture of your life there.
You know, I have to say that I've forgotten so much of my childhood. I think that I actually was a very different person when I lived in Taiwan, because the child that I remember was really fearless and at ease in the world. And if you think about it, why not? I mean, I was surrounded by family. I have my parents, I have my brother, I had aunts, uncles, cousins everywhere. You know, I was in this really full social network. And then we moved to the United States. And I think two things happened. One is the immigration and the other is puberty. And, you know, so I went from a very unselfconscious child coddled by some, you know, a lot of this family to a place where we had no family around. And I didn't speak the language. And, you know, it was just a brand new world. I mean, my family knew a year before we immigrated that we were moving. And my mother and my father, you know, were saying, you should learn at least the English alphabet. And I didn't do it because I didn't believe we would actually leave.
Why?
I guess I was so young that I just didn't think we would. Or maybe I thought it was like a trip. The idea of leaving permanently didn't seem like a possibility to me. And when they would say, when my parents would say, you better learn your alphabet, I would tell them that this is my favorite Chinese saying, which is, I shed no tears until I see the coffin. My memory of Taiwan was that this very full, busy life. It was also, we lived in Taipei, which is a big metropolitan city. And we moved to first Augusta, Georgia.
Oh,
and then
wow.
Savannah, Georgia. And I just thought, I saw, you know, when we drove on the freeway, we see all these land, this empty land. I just never seen so much space. You know, it was quite astounding.
And what was your relationship with your girlhood in a way in Taiwan? And how did it change or evolve when you moved to the U.S.?
I think my girlhood in Taiwan was actually not girlhood. It was mostly, well, actually, that's not true. I was going to say it was mostly childhood, that there was a way in which I wasn't quite aware of being a girl. And I think that's mostly true. Although at the same time, you know, I grew up with people in my family saying things like girls are worthless. You feed girls only to give them away, you know, all these kind of sayings. And so I think I was aware of girlhood as something negative, though I didn't really experience myself as a girl. I think I was very much a child. And I think that one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is, what is the point at which a child becomes aware of his or her gender? You know, and so even though I was always told that I was a girl and that girls can't do anything and that girls are not as good as boys, I never believed that. When I was a child, I didn't believe that. But I think the immigration, being thrust in a world where I had no mastery and being sort of confronted by puberty and all the insecurities that come with it, I started becoming a girl in America. Like feeling myself as a girl around age, you know, 12, right? Which is exactly when that kind of things happened. And it was really devastating. You know, I think that I felt like I wasn't very good at being a Chinese girl because I wasn't obedient enough, certainly back then. And I wasn't pretty by any kind of American standards. So there was a way in which I felt like I became aware of being a girl at the very moment that I realized I was failing at it.
I was reading one of your articles, I believe, in which you said girls were not valued, right? Mm-hmm. But girliness was.
Right.
Why do you think that distinction existed? Does it exist even now?
I think so. I mean, I think that's always been the double bind of, you know, femininity, right? That on the one hand, it is a sign of less than, not strong, not as important. But at the same time, it is supposed to be a sign of desirability. And for it to be a sign of desirability, it must be girly, right? A certain kind of girl, a certain kind of woman. So I remember being put in endless numbers of dresses as a child. My room was pink. My brother's room was blue, as if to remind us exactly who we were supposed to be. And I remember wanting to wear pants or carry around a gun because my brother and I would play and he had all these. You know, he never wanted to play because he was older. He never wanted to play what I wanted to play. So I always had to play what he wanted to play, which is always war. And so there are actually countless photos of me as a small child in very frilly dresses carrying a machine gun. And then I would always be yelled at by my mother or my grandmother in particular, who was very traditional. It's unsightly. Why is she playing with? Why does she have a sword? Why does she have a gun? And so I think that, you know, on the one hand, I was constantly being reminded of what's a girl, what a girl should be, girliness, but at the same time feeling like I'm being asked to be something that actually means I'm less important. It's such a paradox.
It is a paradox. It absolutely is. And beyond cultural norms, which still do exist, especially in Asian cultures in general, like even in Pakistan, having a boy is such an important thing, right?
Right.
Ironically, for practical reasons, because boys become the breadwinners, there are laws, systems, and structures in many patriarchal societies, also in South Asians and Asian societies in general, that facilitate men, whether it's inheritance laws, whether it's cultural norms, whether it's traditions. And hence, many parents want to have boys more than they want girls. Did you see that shift in the US though?
That's an interesting question. I mean, first, I did want to say that I think that what you just said really speaks to why patriarchy is so stubborn, right? So insistent. And it's because it perpetuates itself in all these different ways, culturally, materially, in terms of imagination, in terms of material opportunity, jobs, etc. And so, you know, men get the job, and so they are the breadwinner, and therefore they're more important, I mean, etc., right? And of course, women, you know, throughout history have done a great deal of work. It's just not work that's
valued.
Value, quantified, and paid.
Right.
In terms of money. So America is interesting because I think that there are many ways in which American values are more progressive than some of the more traditional East Asian cultures.
Yeah, I mean, it's a better place to raise girls, though.
It's definitely better. But at the same time, it could be so much better, right? Like, I think about how today, I think about what's happened to Roe v. Wade. I think about how there are states that are trying to reinstate laws from the 1800s. So yes, it's much better in America than other places, but it's all very relative because I think, in fact, you know, America still has a long way to go. And there are some extraordinarily regressive impulses happening in our country today that is totally shocking.
And I want to circle back to what we were talking previously about when you came to the US, you felt like you were failing.
Yes.
How did you overcome that feeling?
What helped me overcome that has been a strength that has also been debilitating in other ways. It's only that I have only come to recently see. So I think in the beginning, how I overcome that was by being a model minority, right? I overcome it by working really hard. You know, I excelled in my language lessons. I mean, let's face it, I'm an English professor. So, you know, I worked hard because also in my family, you know, my family are not the kind of people who ever talk about race or discrimination. We don't talk about what it means to be immigrants, for example. What we talk about is everything is put in terms of personal responsibility. So if you're not good at something, well, then you work hard at getting better at it. If you are failing at something, well, that's your fault. And so I think I overcome it by working really hard. And the part of what I think the reason why I became, and I was always a good student, so I can't blame immigration on this, but I was always a good student, but I became a really hardworking student on my own. In Taiwan, my mother was the one who was always checking homeworks and all that. We came to the United States and she stopped asking about my homework. She was the opposite of a tiger mom. And I years later asked her, how come you never asked? And she said, well, because one, I didn't feel like I could help you with your homework. And two, we just want you to survive. Like, we stopped expecting that much of you when we immigrated. So it's not so much parental expectation, but I think my own effort at trying to have some sense of mastery over my life, you know, so I just work really hard.
Did you in some ways lean into the model minority idea?
Yeah, I absolutely did. As a child, I had no idea what that term meant or that I was doing that. But, you know, I worked hard at school. I worked hard at being liked. It was very important that everyone at school thinks I'm very nice. I was always cheerful. I never showed resentment or anger. I don't even know if I thought I felt them because I was constantly being the good person, the nice person, a diligent person.
But that must be so
exhausting,
exhausting, right?
Well, now I think so.
Right.
And I wrote about this in my scholarship years ago, but I think assimilation takes a tremendous amount of labor. And the better you are at it, the more labor it takes. And the more labor it takes, the more invisible is the goal, right? You're not supposed to show that you're laboring. You're just supposed to look like you were at ease. So I always think the more assimilated a person is, the more invisible labor that they are undertaking.
And this is a good segue into model minority idea. How do you see it now? And do you have any regrets that you leaned into it or you believed in the myth somehow?
Yes. I went through stages of this. First, I was disappointed that I turned out to be the very figure that I critique in class with my students. But then I also, as I get older, I'm also kinder to myself because I sort of think that there are two different ways of approaching the modern minority myth. One is as a myth from the outside, from mostly white cultures, and what that whole stereotype means. And the other way is actually to think about what modern minority means for the Asian American. I think on the first side, in terms of a kind of cultural expectation and stereotype, it's really important to point out that it is a myth, as you said. There are all these things about it that's not true. Not all Asian Americans are, you know, lawyers and doctors and so forth. That Asian American community has one of the highest disparities in income wealth, for example. And it is also a term that was coined in the 1960s, almost deliberately as a sort of dig at so-called welfare queen. So it was used as a kind of leverage to drive a wedge between African-American, you know, Asian-American communities to use it to shame African-Americans. So it is a myth. It's very important to point out it is a myth and that it has all these harmful expectations around it. Having said that, though, I think it's also important to think about the ways in which that even though it might be a myth, it is such a dominant fiction for Asian Americans. And I don't say that with critique. I say it with empathy, because I think if you think about it, if your only choice in American cultures is to be either the yellow peril or the model minority, then you're going to pick the model minority.
Yeah.
Right? Because the choices are very limited. So what I mean to say is that for Asian Americans, it's important to think about why is it that people do buy into this myth? What does it do for them? Even as we pay attention to how harmful it is to buy into this myth, because the kind of expectations that it imposes, especially I think on young people, I teach at a university, I work with a lot of young people. So I'm very alert to the ways in which the modern minority becomes an internalized demand that they place on themselves, which can be incredibly harsh and brutal.
When you say Asian community, you're talking about East Asians, South Asians. It's the broader Asian community here, right?
It is, because I think that these communities are incredibly diverse in all kinds of ways. Their relationship to U.S. history, their national differences, their own international and intranational relations. It's all, you know, it's incredibly complex, right? But it's also hard not to realize that for the large American culture, Asian is just Asian.
Right.
I once heard this great quote by someone who said that you can only be Asian outside of Asia.
Yeah. I want to play devil's advocate for a minute. While harmful in many ways, do you think this model minority myth idea, whatever you call it, makes Asians, again, mostly East Asians, South Asians as well, appear less threatening to American society and hence they can assimilate or integrate easily without being targeted?
The answer is yes. But the second answer is that if only that were actually true. I think that yes, it was a rhetoric designed to tame Asian Americans, to make them more acceptable, to make it more useful. And for the Asian Americans and for people of Asian descent in America, it is a useful, you know, it is not unlike the American dream, right? It is a aspiration that assimilates you to the larger culture that makes you part of the, really the rat race, but it's thought of as really as part of the opportunity, right? It's being given. But I do think that one of the more harmful side effects of that is that while it seems like, you know, the working myth is that if you're a model minority, then you'll be accepted. But that's actually not true. There is a very famous psychology test done by the psychologist Susan Fiske, where she asked majority of people, white people mostly, what they thought about Asians on two particular scales, on the scale of competence and on the scale of likability. And you would not be surprised to learn that almost everyone thought that Asians of all various Asian ethnic groups were highly competent and knowledgeable, but almost all thought they were unlikable.
It's very interesting.
It's very interesting, right? That paradox tells us something about the doubleness of model minority, that it is on the one hand something that is supposed to integrate you, and it does integrate you, but in a certain way, but it still excludes you in other ways.
It's almost as if you can integrate and you are acceptable and useful in a non-threatening way because you cannot challenge white supremacy,
right?
Because you are in a way approximating to that whiteness,
right,
as well. And so you're implicated in those systems and structures.
But you're never white.
Exactly. We don't have to like you, but we can almost use you as a tool to promote and perpetuate our white supremacy.
Absolutely. I think Asian Americans have been used in this sort of racial triangulation for centuries by American politics.
I never thought of it that way. Likeability is not a trait or dimension that I have thought of when I think of Asian identity, my Asian identity. Granted, I have added layer of Muslim identity, which makes things a lot more complicated. Because American society has such a visceral reaction to Muslim identity against Muslims that it's almost as if what I could achieve through Asianness is almost discounted through my Muslimness, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And it's always these kind of layered, nuanced processes of racialization, the sort of like the double racialization that you're talking about, that's always at play in American racial dynamics. It's never very simple. Like, I think, for example, race in America has never, ever been simply black and white, even if it always seems to be speaking that way. By that, I meant that there has always been in American culture since colonial time to this day, where the racialization of Blackness, for example, has often used and relied on racialization of other groups. So I'll give you some examples. I think historically, a good example is how during the sort of the battle to desegregate the nation in Brown v. Board of Education, the case of Japanese internment was brought up during the process in order to justify the segregation of African Americans. By saying, we've done this before, we do it for security, we do it for national security. So there's always the ghost of another race operating in this black and white dyad. And then more recently, or more contemporary to our time, we could think about the whole debate over affirmative action, for example, and how Asian Americans have been literally used in order to serve as a kind of face for white separatist ideals. And so I think that, you know, race has always operated in these sort of triangulated ways, even if the third party is not always visible.
Why aren't other racial identities aware of this trap?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think it's partially because mostly they are not taught this in history. You know, when you go through the public school system in the United States, when I was growing up, were Asian Americans even in my history books? No. And in fact, when I was in high school in the American South, in my history book, I still remember the chapter on the Civil War was mostly about the cotton gin. They didn't even talk about slavery that much. And now you have people actually trying to like prohibit certain history from being taught in schools. And also think that a lot of immigrant community that are not as connected to mainstream media, for example, might be prey to more partial or biased rhetoric or demagoguery. So I think that, you know, there's a lot. I mean, when Ed Blum went to a group of Asian American parents in Texas and told them, you have to join these law schools against Harvard because your child's admission is at stake. It's being taken over by all the Black students, which is totally not true. Like, statistically not true. But, you know, but he tried to do this through two white women, right? He put forward two cases and those didn't win. And he actually said on record, he actually said, I need Asian plaintiffs.
And I want to bring another dimension to this, this idea of beauty and identity. And you've talked about that.
Yes.
How do you see Western ideas of beauty play into how different racial identities see themselves within the broader American society?
I think beauty has always been a very problematic thing for women. It gives them certain kinds of power, but it also commodifies them. And it's always been a kind of a double bind for women. And I think beauty for women of color is especially problematic because, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this question. Can you be a woman? Can you be a feminist? And can you be a woman of color and still participate in acts of beauty without self-harm?
Hmm.
And so I feel like beauty is complicated for women of color because on the one hand, they have historically been excluded from that category because Black beauty hasn't been thought of as beauty. Asian beauty has been thought of as beauty. So they've been excluded from it. So their ability to own and possess or participate in that is really important. But at the same time, it puts them in jeopardy to be commodified, fetishized, et cetera. I think about the great, what they used to call race beauty of the 20th century, women like Josephine Baker or Anna May Wong. And I think about how their beauty and their celebrity offer them a way out, but they were also traps because both of them were first forced very often to play either primitivist roles or orientalist roles. So, I mean, they're exceptional women, but they're good examples of how beauty can offer a way out, but also a way out by being a trap.
Hmm.
So beauty is kind of an ugly business, I think, for women of color. I think part of what makes beauty harmful is that on the one hand, in terms of sort of major mainstream culture, on the one hand, it seems completely a given, right? That is to say, when we go to see the movie Barbie with Margot Robbie as Barbie, we know immediately that we understand it to her to be the standard of beauty.
Western standard of beauty, yes.
Western standard of beauty. And even though the movie made an effort to give us all these different kinds of beauties, as we know, there were Black Barbies, there was an Asian Barbie, there was a weird Barbie, all that. But even so, even within the world of that movie with all these different Barbies, everybody knows who the real Barbie was, which is to say Margot, right? The blonde hair, blue eyes. So that standard is so standard, is so given, is so much the default mode. But at the same time, beauty can be such a vague term. You know, what's scary about beauty for me is when people say things like, what are you complaining about as an Asian woman? You know, you're seen as beautiful and exotic. Well, the exotic...
That term itself is so problematic.
Right, exactly. Because part of that is not only objectification, but also a kind of denigration because you are being seen as a thing. You know, I think we say the word objectification all the time now and we understand, you know, oh, it's a bad thing. But if you really think about what that means is that you are being seen as an object. And what it means to be seen as an object is that you no longer have self-determination, will, agency. You have no right to consent. You have no right to self-possession. It's actually a really profoundly dehumanizing, you know, I say that because I think like we get used to saying objectification and we all know it's bad, but we don't really acknowledge how deeply harmful it is.
And you mentioned the movie Barbie. On a scale of 1 to 10 of authentic inclusivity, how would you rate this movie?
Oh, I would say 4 or 3 for trying. And I also think it's not a small thing because, you know, the director had to deal with Mattel, the corporation. And so I'm sure there's a lot of compromises that were made. Whatever more politically radical vision the director might have had, might have been, you know, softened, shaved down, whatever. So, but I think that part of the problem with that movie is that it reminds me that feminism and or multiculturalism are values that only really gets put out in the world when they can be profitable. If they happen to serve the, this is my cynical view of culture, right? Like, or
I like
culture,
cynical.
Right? Like if it serves a view, if it serves profit, then yes. So we just give people just enough feminism or just enough multiculturalism to feel good about themselves, but we don't really actually end up acknowledging it or foregrounding it or celebrating it.
How do you think the rise of social media and digital representation has impacted the way racial identities are constructed, ideas of beauty are perceived today?
Well, I hate to sound like an old person, but I think social media has been extremely harmful, right? Because I think when we're talking about questions of identity around beauty, around race, they're really complicated questions. Like just not when we're talking about modern minority, you know, it's not just that it's bad, right? It's all the complication that that idea brings with it. The affirmations that it gives people, even as it, you know, disclaims them, even if it disqualifies them. I think part of the problem with social media is that there's no room for complication. It's a slogan. It's an image. It's a momentary 2-minute TikTok video. There's really not that much room for thinking.
But don't you think it allows people to see and familiarize themselves with varied ideas of beauty, of what can be beautiful, which did not exist before, right?
That's true. I like the idea of that. I like that proposition. I don't know if it's true, partially because I don't really understand the statistics around who's looking at what. To what extent does social media play to preach, like singing to the choir, right? Are the people looking at the variety and differences, people who are open to do that or not? I mean, I think that's part of the problem around social media is that there's actually very little study around its usage, its influence, its scope. I just don't think people have studied it that much.
Are there any recent trends or movements that you've seen that you find particularly significant in making a shift in how we see beauty intertwined with different racial identities and celebrating the diversity of what is beautiful?
Again, I think that companies like Dove or Forever 21 wouldn't be advertising different visions of beauty, promoting different visions of beauty in different kinds of bodies if it weren't profitable. So I want to sort of say that first. But having said so, it is also true. I do think that just in terms of even major advertising, there has been a change, a shift in what you see as model bodies. And I wish it was done in a more sustained, inclusive way rather than, you know, I'm thinking, for example, of, let's think of a very sort of mainstream thing. Let's think about Victoria's Secret, for example. They are actually now putting up images, at least in their stores, of women of different body sizes. But all their clothes are made for very small people continually to be the case. Yeah. And so I think that there's a way in which I wish diversity would not come in as a kind of appendage.
An afterthought.
Yeah, an afterthought, rather than really a sort of sustained acknowledgement of human difference.
And as a professor, what do you think are the most pressing issues when it comes to how race and aesthetics, beauty intersect?
For young people in particular, I think it's important for them to understand that race and politics and beauty do intersect. I think that for a lot of people, there tend to be the assumption that beauty and aesthetic is the realm separate from politics. So, you know, in 2017, when the Metropolitan Museum put forth the show, China Through the Looking Glass, I don't know if you saw that show, but it was basically a big exercise in Orientalism. But they said at the beginning of the show, there was a plaque on a wall that basically said, this is not about politics. This is just about artists reimagining China or acquiring artists acquiring the inspiration from China. And so there's this assumption, which I think is a very common one, that art and aesthetics and beauty are not related to politics. But part of what my work insists on, and one of the first things that I try to get my students to explore, is precisely the ways in which politics is entangled with aesthetics, how politics can speak through aesthetics, and how possibly aesthetics can change politics.
Give me an example.
Well, I think about the ways in which art, whether it's literature or painting or film, can radically reimagine ideas of identity, for example, and how that kind of reimagining, people might say, oh, that's just in the arts. Who cares? That has nothing to do with the real world. But, you know, I think the ability to imagine otherwise, which is a phrase by a colleague of mine, the ability to imagine otherwise is so important to political imagination. Because if you cannot imagine things otherwise, things will never change. So I think that politics can influence and speak through the arts, but the arts can also speak back to politics.
So within the arts landscape, what are some of the challenges or opportunities that you see emerging in the near future?
Well, I think it is incredibly sad and telling that even as our world is increasingly losing its humanities, our sense of civility and the common good that is being eroded in the last, say, you know, 7 years or so, it is precisely at this time that the humanities is also falling and deteriorating when it is actually the most needed. You know, when I'm in class with my students, for them to think about questions of human value, to thinking about questions of subjectivity, which I think the arts really help us think about and get at, to get them to think about that in the face of the kind of dehumanization, the kind of hostility and incivility that's going on in the world becomes super important.
So how do they reconcile with all these contradictory messages?
Well, that's the other thing that I think is very important to learn as a young person, is that life is full of contradictions and it's full of paradoxes. And just because something is contradictory doesn't mean it's not true, nor does it mean that you need to resolve it. I think, for example, it's very important to understand identity as itself a contradiction, a paradox. It is the thing that gives you self-affirmation, but it is also the thing that will rarefy you, that would turn you into, that would narrow you, that would reduce you. It is both. It's enabling and it's disabling. It is affirming and it's denigrating. It is both. And it's so important, I think, for students, or people in general, but young people, to recognize that paradox, right? Instead of thinking, oh, identity is a great thing or identity is horrible. It is both. And it's so important to be able to maintain that binary, to hold opposing ideas at the same time. Because in fact, so much of our social cultural experience is centered around these kind of minds, these kind of, you know, doubleness.
What part of identity do you think we should forego in order to broaden our understanding of who we are?
I think one way I might think about that is the thing to let go is the idea that identity is singular or homogeneous. Because once you recognize that you yourself is the product of multiple identities, some of which reinforce each other, some of which don't, but that you are yourself this multiply identified person. When you recognize that about yourself, hopefully that would make you more accommodating to other people's multiple identities. So if you can start by recognizing your own multiplicity, then maybe you can be more accommodating or accepting of others.
Have you faced those challenges in your personal life?
Absolutely. I feel like I live those challenges every single day. You know, thinking about being a mother, being a wife in an interracial relationship, being a daughter, being a professor, being a scholar, being a writer, being a creative person, being, you know, it just constantly, there's so many multiple demands of identity placed on you. And it's part of what I call ordinary disaster. You know, it's like the ordinary thing that everyone has to contend with. So I think that part of what I think has been helpful for me in writing these essays is it helps me articulate or say out loud all these contradictions that have pulled at my life. And oftentimes uncomfortably, oftentimes painfully, but I think being able to write about them really helped. Not that I resolved them by writing about them, but being able to be clear about what the different demands are that you're trying to negotiate all the time, that helps. I think the clarity helps. It's not about solving the problem. It's about being clear what the problem is.
And what part of your identity is most emancipating and what is most limiting for you in this moment?
I think being a writer has been the most freeing for me. I think I'm a braver person in my writing than I am in my life. I think there are things I say in my writing that I'm afraid to say in person. So the writing is a place of freedom for me. Doesn't mean it's easy. It can be super painful. Sometimes I wonder, why do I do this? But it is a place of freedom for me. I think the most restrictive for me right now, actually, I mean, is being a daughter. My mother is 88, is going through dementia, has recently fallen and become physically disabled. And it has really put so much pressure on how much can I give of myself to her care. I mean, the care is multiple and immediate. It's like having a child again, right? This person just needs you. But at the same time, I have my own life. I have a job. So it's about negotiating on that. So I feel like right now, being a daughter is the most difficult and challenging identity that I'm trying to grapple with. I just don't have enough time. I need more time.
And in the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
I like to think about America as an aspiration, because democracy, if you think about it, is such a precious gift, but it's also so hard.
And it's messy.
It's messy. Well, it means that you have to identify with people who may not be like you. It means you have to work with people who might completely disagree with you, whose interest is different than your own. It is a tremendous ethical aspiration. But remembering as aspiration, I think, is super critical, because I think in the last several years, there has been so much cynicism and hatred and hostility and also greed going on that people have forgotten that the thing that we hold most value is something we must aspire to and continue to aspire to. When I was younger, like a teenager, I used to think that it didn't matter very much who the president was, because it's the whole government running the show, right? Not one person. And it's still certainly true. But now I realize how important it is that the president be someone who represents, even if they cannot embody 100% all the time, but they can at least represent an ethical ideal. So that's why I think it's aspirational. It's something that has to happen. We have to keep striving for. It's something that we have to keep working at. It's not a given, and it's in jeopardy all the time.
Thank you so much, Anne. This was such a fun conversation.
It is.
Important conversation. Do you have a website? Is there a place they can go and buy your books?
I would love people to read my latest book, which is my first book of personal essays. I've been, you know, I'm an author of 3 other books of scholarship, but this is the first time I've written in a personal way. And it was both scary, but also really liberating. It's called Ordinary Disasters. The subtitle is How I Stopped Being a Modern Minority. And it's coming out of Pantheon in 2 weeks. And I think you can order on Amazon, but you can also get it from Pantheon or other places, bookstores.
Wonderful, Anne. Thank you so much, Anne. I appreciate this.
Thank you. So nice meeting you.
You know, every time I sit down with my guests, I have so many new insights and thoughts after I end my conversation. I feel energized. I feel informed, challenged, questioned. It's such a heartwarming and hopeful place in a way. This work is so important to me, and I'm so glad that I have all of you coming back, hopefully every week, to listen to these conversations, to be part of the journey that I'm on with my guests. If you don't know, or if you haven't subscribed to our channel on Apple Podcasts, please do. This is how we grow. You can subscribe to ad-free content for as low as $3.99 a month. Support us in other ways. You can follow us on social media. You can share our content. You can give us a good review. Guys, all of it matters. It helps us sustain Immigrantly Media as a company where we are producing content that really, really speaks to who we are authentically and unapologetically. This episode was produced by me, written by me. The editorial review is done by Shay Yu. Our editor and sound designer is Hazik Ahmed Farid. Our theme music is done by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week when I have another insightful conversation for all of you. Take care.